From Iowa City, Iowa Public Radio presents Live from Prairie Lights, America's best writers reading from their poetry and prose from Prairie Lights Bookstore. Support for this program comes from Prairie Lights Bookstore, 15 South Dubuque Street, Iowa City. We are broadcasting over WSUI AM 910, WOI AM 640, and over the internet, wsui.uiowa.edu. Also, the Live from Prairie Lights programs are archived on our website. You can listen to them anytime, anywhere in the world. Working through the awful trauma of child cruelty, aided by art, the Bible, and the poetry of Holocaust survivor Paul Celan. On this edition of Live from Prairie Lights, Mary Rako reads from her new book, The Memory Room, published by Counterpoint. I'm Julie Englander. The Memory Room takes us into the dark recesses of a woman named Barbara coming to terms with the abuse she endured as a child at the hands of her parents. The scenes, sometimes obscure, other times vivid, pop off the page in Rako's non-traditional form, white space and brief lines of sharp prose. Barbara unfolds her terrible childhood and reinvents or transcends herself in the memory room, which may take the form of many places. In her own mind, in the therapy of a nameless counselor, in the company of her boyfriend, in the memorable presence of art, in Celan's poetry, and in religious thought. Navigating through grief and memory, she must reconstruct a new self, one able to bear stimulations not even imagined by the self she has left behind. With The Memory Room, Mary Rako has created a novel that affirms the resilience of the human spirit and the healing power of love, faith, and culture. Publishers Weekly Starred Review says, with subtlety, restraint, and an extraordinary eye for detail, Rako has constructed a breathtaking debut that avoids the cliches of abuse narratives as it tests the boundaries of prose and poetry. Drawing from the Psalms and the poems of Paul Celan, Rako has written a novel that distills the mysteries of suffering, faith, and salvation into a complex yet accessible whole. The horror of her tale is ultimately redressed by the sensitivity and skill with which it is told. Mary Rako comes to the field of writing a bit late in life, she says. She had her fears about embracing the literary form early on, she will explain. She is a native of California and earned the master's degree in theological studies from Harvard University Divinity School and the PhD degree in theology from Boston College. She lives with her husband and children in Los Angeles. Please welcome Mary Rako to Live from Prairie Lights.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. This is an honor to be here. In Los Angeles, people know very much about Prairie Lights Bookstore and consider it very much an icon bookstore, an ideal place for writers and readers. And it's really a little intimidating to read here, even though I've been welcomed really warmly. It's very much an honor. And it's also exciting to meet people in preparation for tonight here who live here who know the work of Paul Celan. It's just an exciting thing. 5 years ago when I first met Celan's work, no one that I knew of him, and John Felstener, his principal biographer and one of his primary translators, testified to the same experience. So, you know, it's very nice that's changing. And so I'm going to read from the novel various sections. The only things you need to know are there are two characters. That one is a neighbor, Josephine. One is Bob, who owns Bob's nursery. Barbara is a gardener, and at one point I'm going to be reading from Fundus, a chapter in which she hopes to plant and bonsai a Chinese magnolia tree, and she buys the tree from Bob. The only other things are that the the psalm texts and the words of Paul Celan enter her consciousness, and I try to indicate that, like the memories themselves, by using italics on the page. Since you don't have the book in front of you, I'll try to kind of indicate that by my voice, but I'm going to go ahead. Since this is a group that already I know many people know the work of Paul Celan, I'm going to go ahead and read sections that include those words. Sometimes at readings I don't do that because it would be confusing, and but I feel confident that we can do that here together, and it's a joy for me because I love the work of Paul Celan, and I want to make a plug for my friend because without John Felstener, my German would never allow me into the world of Paul Celan. And also, there are other translators into English that are very good, Michael Hamburger, Pierre Joris, people like that. But I first met Paul Celan through the work of John Felstener, and this is his biography of Paul Celan, which is kind of a biography of the work of Paul Celan, how Celan's work comes from his life. And it's a really good entrance into Celan. And then 2 years ago, with Norton, Felstener came out with a very wonderful anthology of the selected prose and poetry of Paul Celan. And so it's a wonderful volume. But I think this is a wonderful place to start. And you can see I still, it's like my Bible at home. So we'll start with Introit, the beginning of the book. And can we all hear in the back? Okay. I wonder on this first day of October why I can't solve the simplest things. It was the new student, the one from Cambodia, who found me crouched in the corner when the doors finally opened and the light came back on. So slowly, he put his books down next to me, carefully lifting me out, his expression saying he would never tell. Anyone would panic stuck in an elevator, the department chair said tenderly, but I thought, not like I did, they don't. 7 times I stood before my students, white as a sail, unable to remember my thoughts, my hands gripping the podium's edge. 7 times in 1 year. I need an immediate leave of absence, I said, and he was not surprised. His large office with its pictures of Loisy, Newman, a framed photo of himself with 4 other seminarians when they were young, in cassocks, leaning onto each other, the brilliant grillwork of a gate. Can you stay for the reception at least, he asked. You're the one he'll want to talk to. And I thought, it can't be worse than my students today. Their wide and vacant eyes, their faces like empty plates. Past the curtain, St. Ignatius stood in marble on the empty lawn. Fog through the plate glass windows formed droplets on the eucalyptus leaves high above the faculty, alumni, the bishop, while the scholar from Boston stood near me pouring sherry. But I could not recall the title of his book, his name, or the journal that published my favorable review, because he wore a charcoal sport coat with small raspberry flecks, and with it a shirt of minute houndstooth, red. And all I could think was, red, next to raspberry, red, reduced, mute, you. You who have eyes to see this chasm between hues, you could see me. This is how therapy starts. She is not a therapy hip person. She's educated, but she's never been in therapy before. And she tries everything else first. And finally goes. This is her first session. Can we sit without talking? Black milk of daybreak, we drink it at evening, we drink it at midday and morning, we drink it at night. Yes, he answers without hesitating. Even in his tone, he doesn't ask for an explanation. I don't have to say I must feel the texture of this air, the exact silence that surrounds you. We sit the entire hour without speaking. I watch him. And he watches me. The silence feels good. He seems comfortable with my emptiness. He doesn't need me to make this time meaningful for him. I feel free to be of no consequence. At the end, he asks if I want another session. He suggests next week at 5 o'clock. I can't come at dusk, I confess. To be here, I need the full strength of the sun. For 6 Tuesdays, we do not talk. We just sit. It is all I want. May I ask you a question, I say. It is our 7th week and my first time speaking. It's personal. It's about this room. Sure, he smiles. May I touch your walls? He nods. With two fingers held together, I trace a line around the room. My fingertips record a sequence of textures. Wood door, plaster wall, cloth-bound books, glass sliding door that opens to a deck, plaster again over the couch, and last, the cool handle of the door. I make around myself an invisible, closed loop. Our feet shall stand within thy gates, O Jerusalem. I'd like to do this every time, I say, if I'm going to talk here. And I think I see something good there in his face. The next session, he wears a different shirt and tie, different slacks and socks. Only his shoes are the same as last week. But through my fingertips, the sequence on the wall stays the same, despite the 7 days. Each week, I trace my loop around the walls, within thy gates, O Jerusalem. His shirts and socks and ties change, varied permutations of color, pattern, texture brought together on his body, simple elements, carefully observed, composed, held, as if a person might be similarly understood. He invites me to look at something outside in the pond just past the deck. It's a freshwater trout, he says. I look through the glass door. Small fins on the sides of its body move rapidly back and forth, yet the fish remains in the same place, hovering in shallow water, a bright patch of light. Every few minutes, it turns to face another direction, but the body, fluttering its small fins, stays over the same spot. What's she doing? I ask. He does not look over at me. He does not make me have too much of him. A man lives in the house. He plays with his vipers. She's guarding her eggs, he says, aerating the water. The mother and father take turns. Your goldenest hair, Margareta, your ashenest hair, Shulamith. I'm sorry, I head for the door. It's too hard for me to see. If she would just eat half the eggs, it would be easier, less beautiful, less pain. Barbara has gone to the art museum and the neighborhoods around the art museum. She sees a tree. This is in a different part of town. She's not sure what it is. She goes to Bob's nursery. He tells her it's a Chinese magnolia tree, a tulip tree. And she buys the best one that he has there and brings it home and is planning to plant it in the yard. He suggests that she bonsai the tree because she has all these big trees in her yard already. And he gives her a book about a bonsai technique. And she likes the idea. So this is what happens. Bob's book is filled with new words, foreign and promising, singed ends, gins, sharis, the driftwood effect. Nomenclature with Zen roots, space, tranquility, it's just what I want. Tomorrow, as if in Buddhist robes, I'll sanctify the day, I'll rise early, I'll move in the slow air of contemplation, I'll meditate on each aspect of the tree, measure this against a vision of what, with time, it will become. With snippers, I'll remove what doesn't belong, then wrap soft rose-colored wire around the branches that remain. I'll aim myself toward the future with this tree. I'll be resilient like Bob, his rows of cypress and juniper, his bare legs in the rain. I'll train my thinking away from my past. Josephine calls too early. I don't know how to answer her. Already my head aches. I mix organic soil with the sand. Still my head hurts. 4 aspirin and still the pain is sharp and demanding. Something isn't right. Even the sun, good-natured and reappearing, is drying out the leaves. What if no one came, that student from Cambodia? What if no one turned on the lights? I was already on the cold middle floor, already whimpering. I pull a jacket on over my sweatshirt. My arms are still cold. Why was his face so calm and his cheekbones? My hand shaking on the handle of the shovel. My boot misses the blade. This is not tranquility. Luckily, Bob cut the can. It opens like a shell. But that totality of dark, that cold. I press harder, my neck, my freezing back. A man lives in the house. He plays with his vipers. He whistles his hounds to come close. Crawl up there, Barbara, a little further. I pour soil into the hole. set in the tree, my socks fill with dirt, I can't remember my zip code. I yank a slip of bark that hangs loose on the trunk. Keep going, Barbara, find the shovel. What year is it? What day of the week? I cut the branches that grow to the left, take them all off, the branches that grow to the right. My father in his blue canvas shoes. Why is that car driving so slow? What is she looking at? Nothing stops this cold. I hack off the top, the crown, the mound of leaves on the sidewalk. They shrivel in the sun. The heat is killing them. I can't get warm. A man lives in the house he plays. He grabs for the rod. He looses his hounds. Jab your blades, your spades deeper. Black milk of daybreak. Grave in the clouds. The tree isn't a tree at all now. Just a trunk. No branches. No top. I throw wire around it. Pull hard. Cut off the air. I'll stop all the fluids. This cold's going to kill me. I'm dying under here. For God's sake, Barbara. Oh, please don't be Josephine. Yesterday, sparrows lived in the hedge, but today I'm not sure. What are you doing? I'm probably already dead. Give me those shears. I'm breaking into enzymes. Look at me, Barbara. I'm disassembling blue canvas shoes. I'm broken into particles. The soil is taking me in. Damn it, Barbara, stop. Let me go. I hold onto the bathroom counter, the edge, the grout. She's followed me in. What the hell have you done? She stands at the door. Where are your rugs, the drapes? Where is everything? Cold tile against my cheek. Please don't make me look at you. Where's that doctor's card? I want his emergency number. I'll do it, Josephine. Look at you. I am dissolved. Water carries me away. This is Josephine Bremen. Of course this is an emergency, young lady. No, I'm not a client. Of course I want him paged immediately. Her voice is the caw of a crow. Who will bring me to the strong city? Her hem flutters against her calf, fabric on bare skin. Heat flows out and away from me. I'm hemorrhaging. I could touch her body. I could touch her life-giving hem. Nothing makes me warm. I put on my coat, the quilt, wrap one of the towels around my head, and crawl into bed. Where are you? In bed. Can you drive? Yes. He has an opening at 3 o'clock. I make it to the parking lot. Coat, quilt, sweatshirt, towel. It doesn't matter. I'm not cold anymore. I have no temperature, no pulse. Far away, two boys play on the bridge. Ducks below. Nobody breathes. He opens my car door. He helps me out. The towel falls off my head. He sets it on the seat. Shoes move on the wood of the bridge. They are my shoes. He leads me down the hall. He sits me on a couch. His lips open and close. I do not hear. I am the girl already dead. He holds two of his fingers in front of my face. Watch me, he says. He touches fingers to the walls. He traces a loop around me like a coffin. Show me what happened. He balances a tablet on my lap. This is your tablet, Barbara. He opens to a blank sheet. These are your crayons. He presses my palm to the box. Can you draw a picture of what happened? I have no temperature, no pulse. Please. I take a black crayon. I touch the sharp point of wax to the white. I move it one way. I move it back. I move it one way. I move it back. I move it until all the white is gone. All the light has disappeared. Good, a voice says. He aims my face at his eyes. Can you tell me what happened? Two blue eyes on either side of a nose. Can you tell me about the black? It would make me very happy if you could tell me what happened, Barbara. You've already been very brave coming here today. Can you tell me what the picture says? Water, the drop that hangs, falls from the wire. My father was in his navy blue canvas shoes, the ones with the rubber soles. He said, go find the candle. I kept crawling. I thought it was a new game. The space got smaller. It was under the house. A candle was burning in the dirt. The hole was shaped like half a melon. He called up to me, get in. The dirt was cold against my back. Then he came crawling on his hands and knees. He scooped dirt onto my legs with his army shovel, then with his hands. He poured dirt onto my arms and chest, my neck and chin. He patted it down. He put the straws in my mouth. They were green and white flexi straws. He covered my mouth, my nose. He pressed the dirt on my eyes. I couldn't keep the straws in. I got cold, and I wasn't cold anymore. I wasn't anything. Your father buried you in the dirt under the house. Yes. I'm the dead girl. I have no pulse. Can you look at me? A voice shatters the cedars of Lebanon. The tablet is pressed around my face like the bow of a ship. I bring it down. His face is there like always. Two eyes, a nose, a shirt. I hide myself in the threads of his tie under the maple leaf there in the teal blue. He leads me over the bridge to my car. The stillness of the pond is all I want. It is too much to be a human thing. I dream. I am a buried girl who now is standing addressing an audience of adults. They listen. They take notes. I am telling them about the dirt. I wake. It does not feel like a dream. It feels like revelation. I go downstairs, sit at my desk, and write every word the young girl said. I'd like to give a lecture, if you don't mind, I say after tracing my loop on the walls. Great, he says. He sits taller in his chair. I stand as if behind a podium. The lecture is titled, What Every Buried Child Knows. The ducks are on the water. The eucalyptus tree extends its arm. I will open my dark saying upon the harp. I clear my throat, straighten my papers, and begin. If someone looks under a house and sees a mound of dirt moving slowly up and down, with two green and white striped straws coming out one end, they might say, "This is cruelty. That mound breathes so like a human." But cruelty is a matter of degree. This is something every buried child knows. When I was under the dirt, my father could not touch me, and afterward, there was no blood. An ordinary person looks through the ripped opening in the foundation of a house, the place where the phone man crawls through to hook up a new line, and says, "That is dirt in there," as if dirt were one thing. But if you are a child and your father is burying you under the house, you tell yourself dirt is not one thing, but many. The particles come off the pointed end of the army shovel onto your arms and chest, and you tell yourself dirt is not one thing, but many. Each particle is here with me. Each particle counts. And in this way, with the dirt, you outnumber your father. When he presses the dirt against your legs folded up on your chest and you feel the cold come in, you tell yourself, the dirt is kind. It wants me to be cold. It wants me not to burn. When the dirt falls slowly from your father's palms, carefully onto your face, and you hear his breathing shorten and accelerate, and his eyes become like glass, you know this is the hardest part, because he looks right down at you but doesn't see you there, and because your head is fixed firm, you are forced to watch him become a person you no longer know, and it is impossible to bear, but between you and your father's changing face is the dirt, and you make the dirt speak louder than anything else, and you make it say, "Watch the way we fall, Barbara. We are coming down onto you gently, the way rain falls on the fuchsia bush, making the leaves dark green with jags of pewter light. And you become the fuchsia bush that stands next to the house, how it waits, as if by prior agreement, for the rain's gentle touch. When you hear the muffled sound of your father crawling away, and you feel the dirt tightening on your face like a mask, as if it were one thing, you still make the dirt say, "We are not one thing but many, bound together like a mask, bound together making a wall between you and your father." And you hold on to this as the most important truth around which all other truths must find their place. When finally the cold moves deeply through your body and you can no longer keep the straws between your teeth and you feel the pull towards sleep, you find yourself able to say, "Dirt is not one but many, and the particles are good." And in this way, you leave behind the world in the condition you expect it to be. Because even as a child, you refuse to live where cruelty outnumbers kindness. Because even as a child, you demand a moral order, and you create it if it cannot be found. I fold my papers and look up, his face slackened by tears. Like the host carried in a flat gold pyx, the pyx wrapped in a linen cloth, the cloth slipped in the pyx bag on a cord around the priest's neck. This is the way the sacred body enters the world, hidden in a pyx. This is the way pain travels, hidden, covered, sealed. A stone covered by a handkerchief gets wet in the rain. Water seeps through the weave of the finest Irish linen. The stone, hard and stubborn, keeps its original curve and weight. Only a lifting of the corporal dries the stone, only opening the pyx. Sitting on my parents' bed, the spread, a deep green ivy print. My mother gave me her button jar. I set the buttons out in snake-like rows, orange, brown, navy blue. My father sat on the foot of the bed, watching football on his new TV. The glittering gold thread running through the speaker cloth, the movements of the small men. He stood to move the rabbit ears, sat back down, stood up again, up, down. Each time he stood, my button lines slid into each other. Each time he sat back down, I made them straight again. His white undershirt, the sleeves rolled high, holding a pack of cigarettes, his black hair slicked with pomade. So close, I almost touched him. So close, my buttons almost slid right up against his back. It was an ordered thing. Sunlight watching from the bedroom walls. Last piece. Tomorrow will be a good day. I'll get right out of bed, I'll assume the posture of an upright mammal, take my human place among the phyla. I'll go outside and see what the night has changed. I'll water my garden. The bottom of my nightgown will get damp and dirty from the hose. And in every way, I will be normal. I turn off the light. St. John on Patmos. They say he was inspired. I say he wrote his visions down to save himself. Exiled, no one to talk to. No one to listen, his hair in knots infested with lice, casting out his net of words, hoping to catch himself like a fish. I tried to see him. Perhaps it was like this. He touches the trunk of a palm, its segmented leaves like playing cards, but rough against his hands, and whispers to it, "Wasn't I the one he loved? Wasn't I the one who rested on his breast?" The trunk, mute, the fronds silent above. He pokes a CNN enemy with a stick. You there, speak up. That last night with the tearing of the bread, didn't he say he loved me? The anemone closes in, withdrawing its soft, mushy green. Each night he recites a litany to the fire. I, John, was there when he raised Jairus' daughter from the dead. I was there on the holy mountain when he became like light. Peter and James were with me. They are my witnesses. They would say, it happened, and I was the one he loved. When the driftwood turns from red to white, he tells himself, this is corroboration. He forgets to take shelter from the sun. His eyebrows whiten. His lashes grow thick and interwoven. His skin gathers to itself a calcium casing of sea salts. Sand crabs make their home on the topsides of his feet. His hair grows long. He wraps it around his waist like a belt. After 100 days, he no longer remembers the house of Jairus or Moses and Elijah on the holy mountain, how they stood in the flagrant light. Instead, he hears tambourines and the small sound of finger drums in the night, trumpets. He sees stars falling like candlesticks. He dreams of locusts shaped like horses wearing crowns of gold, their tails like scorpions with deadly sting. He hears strange words, Gog and Magog, in his sleep. Waking, he thinks, now it is happening. I am going mad. He calls the sand whoremonger, the sea anemone sorcerer. He curses them all into a lake of fire. He no longer wants someone to say, it happened, John, Jairus, the holy mountain leaning on his breast. It's all your history. It all belongs to you. Instead, he tells himself, I am a sea urchin with purple spines. I have no memory, no feelings, no thought at all. Still, the visions come. An earth scorched by fire, sea black as sackcloth, the moon blood. He curses memory, calls it mother of harlots, Babylon. He sits as still as a stone, tells himself, I am no longer a sea urchin with purple spines. I am not here at all. A silverfish lands on the shore, large, like none he's seen before. He smells it and thinks, the pelican must have left this for me. Even though he has never seen the pelican. He does not eat the fish. He refuses to believe in miracles. He feels a pecking on his cheek. With his fingers, he pulls apart his lids. Salt crumbles in his fingertips. On his shoulder, a black crow sits with its narrow yellow beak. He knows it is not an island bird. He hears voices. Soldiers lift him to their boat. They say, we have a new emperor. Your exile is revoked. In the rocking of the boat, he hears the voice of the one he once loved, saying, John, I come quickly. In the sky, he finds a woman clothed with the sun. He sees the distant coastline, white roofs of houses, and thinks, they are taking me to the holy city. I see its foundation laid with jasper and chalcedony. He calls to the soldiers, look, we are going to paradise. John's words crossed the Aegean. New Christians found themselves caught in his net. So many silverfish, they canonized him. They didn't call him John the Raving, John the Lunatic. They named him the Beloved, John the Divine. They gathered his nightmares into a book and they called it Revelation. In the morning, I put on sunscreen, get dressed. I finish feeding the azaleas, coil up the hose. Bob's note is tacked above my workbench. Josephine is next door. The sound of her television comes through the hedge. Helene and Dolores Mary are in the convent not far away. And inside my loop, the listening one, the one who returns to me, bringing all of my parts, remembered, bringing the sheaves. I am not on Patmos. I am not alone. I am the lucky one. I am Fortunatus. In the privacy of this green, I make a pledge, witnessed by the leaves, that I will vest myself with the crooked staff of a shepherd, and my crozier, and with my crozier, I will gather even the lowliest memory that has fallen, lost, into the ditch. With my staff, I will govern my body. I alone will be its curate. My history will be my new parish, and I will make inside myself a new city, a holy place, a new Jerusalem. Thank you.
You're listening to Live from Prairie Lights with Mary Rako, reading from her new book called The Memory Room, published by Counterpoint Books. And it's a very wonderful presentation, and it's such an aural book, it seems. It's made to be voiced, do you think? I'll need you to stand here to answer questions, Mary.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks.
Well, yes. I mean, people tell me they read it out loud, which I like. I read it out loud. I mean, I think it's a text that makes most sense to me heard out loud.
Yeah.
So, you know, I try to show how I hear it by how I place the ink on the white of the page.
Right.
I have to orchestrate that.
Mary Rako will take questions from the audience here at Prairie Lights Bookstore. Her book is The Memory Room, and there's one way back here.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Paul Celan, for some of those who don't know, some of those out in the great radio land,
yeah,
who might not have the sense of why he is such a meaningful poet in your life and the effect he had on this particular book.
Oh, I'd be happy to. Paul Celan wrote in German. He lost both parents in the Holocaust. He also was in, for I think about 9 months or a year, worked in a work camp himself. He eventually settled in Paris, but wrote in German. And he killed himself, it seems very much that it was a suicide, by jumping into the Seine. He was a strong swimmer in 1970. He's now translated quite a bit into English, but he's been very, very big in Europe, I think considered a major, maybe the major post-World War II poet, I think, but he's starting to be known in the U.S. And in German you can make nouns from putting nouns together. You know, you can make compounds, so you can unlike English for the most part, you can construct words. And his what I like very much about his work is that it's not a narrative about the destruction of meaning or the crisis in meaning and the crisis in language that was precipitated or that was the result of the Holocaust, but it embodies that crisis. So it's really shattered. His poetry is like if you had a pot, an incredible pot, and you threw it on the ground, you had a zillion pieces of clay, and then you put them together in these various ways. And so his work is very, I just responded to it for this story because my character Barbara responded to it because even though their experiences are very different and on a different scale, and one is private and one is very political and all that stuff, their experiences of certain kinds of, we could call it evil or moral depravity or horrible, you know, cruelty, always generates a crisis in language. And so, for example, I was writing what has become the memory room in conventional scenes, and I heard about an event that happened in Los Angeles, and I could no longer write scenes, and I couldn't write margin to margin, and so I experienced that as an author myself. And I think that, you know, the question, can we even write poetry after the Holocaust, or Dorner's question, is it's a question for anyone who encounters or is sufficiently aware of real cruelty. Our tremendous capacity for cruelty as a human species, as a species. So I think that Paul Celan resonated with me in a very deep way, and actually it was the first time I ever wept about the Holocaust was after hearing a tape of Paul Celan reading Death Fugue, his most famous poem. And I was, I'm ashamed to say, in my 40s when that happened. But I had never really been touched by that atrocity until that poem.
So you, what I read is you brought Celan's work into this work after this had been written.
Yeah, well, I thought it was finished about four different times. Yeah, so So, I mean, at this stage, I have this novel manuscript, and I thought it was finished, and it had a certain integrity. But once I heard Paul Ceylon, I felt he was necessary for the novel, and he was necessary for Barbara's reconstruction of her own identity. And so the novel began as kind of a piece for solo cello, I guess, and then it became kind of like concerto form. And when I encountered Paul Ceylon, then I began to get a full orchestra, which became full when, through Paul Ceylon, I personally went back to begin reading scripture again, primarily the Psalms. And so once I had the basic story, and then I had Paul Ceylon, and I had the Psalms, I felt I had a full orchestra. And so then I felt it really was finished.
Mary Rako is our guest, Counterpoints of Press, but her book is called The Memory Room. Other questions or comments for her? Let me know. It's fascinating how you formed this. Where did you... there's one back here. Okay, sorry.
Well, you've touched on it a bit, but I was very interested in the form and the way in which it seems to be transgenre, and I was just interested in those choices and how...
Okay. It's a long story, but I'll say a couple of preliminaries that are embarrassing, but they're very true. The form of the novel developed in a very organic way, not in relation to literary forms or literary texts. I didn't really feel comfortable reading works of the imagination until I was about 3 years into writing The Memory Room. I didn't read as a child. I didn't read as a teenager. I read nonfiction, but I did not read... the first time I read any... freely, that wasn't assigned in school. The first time I read something was a poem at my son's college graduation. One of the speakers quoted Mary Oliver's poem Trilliums, and I liked it. And I went to, this was at Berkeley, and I went to Black Oak Bookstore, and shaking and feeling like I was going to throw up, I found the poetry section. I found Mary Oliver, and I opened it up, and I felt, that poem takes two pages basically, and there's a lot of white, and I could see that I could go into it and come out if I wanted to and not get hurt. Basically, it's very embarrassing, but so that was the beginning of my encounter with literature, and so my form, the way it developed, was generally about how I felt in the world. For example, when I was first writing in traditional scenes, and this woman threw her toddler and infant into the Los Angeles River. And the infant died, and the toddler survived, who would now be 12, and she survived. And I could not write in scenes after hearing that. I heard about it through my friends, because I don't read the papers, and everyone was talking about it. And then I did go buy a paper and read the story, and I felt I can't write as if the world were that coherent to this child. I felt he was the only audience I ever envisioned was this, I won't say his name, but I'll probably never meet him. But I felt I couldn't have it look on the page as if life were that coherent. I don't experience it that way myself. So then I wrote just what I call dots. It would be like a few lines on a blank page, and I had thousands of them. And then I grouped them by emotional color and tied them in these various colored ribbons. It sounds very corny, but it worked for me. So, they're green, red, blue, black. And then I wanted to sell the book as a box of cards, not in the convention of linear convention, because that's also very foreign to me. But I was convinced by my wonderful writing group, Hard Words, that this was impossible and I would never get it sold, and they were probably right. So I spent a very long time ordering the dots into the convention of... I never read that way, and now that I do read, I still don't read that way. So that was the hardest thing about the novel, probably, was organizing it in a linear page one, page two, And that was done, but it was still ordered pages that had just a little bit of text in white. And then I gave the manuscript to a friend of mine who's, a 19th century, he's an academic whose specialty is the 19th century, and he read it, and he said, this really reminded him of In Memoriam, and I had never read Tennyson because I'd never read anything, so I lived in In Memoriam for about 4 months, and then the texts that were going across the page, like this, began to break themselves down the center of the page. So then I had 800 or 900 pages of this text all running down the center of the page, really an easy thing to sell from a non, from a new writer. But actually, Counterpoint had it, and two of their readers insisted that they publish it. But Jack, being somewhat practical, said, no, he's not going to publish this 900-page thing. Meanwhile, lucky for me, this brilliant poet, who's a friend of mine, Ilya Kaminsky, said, this doesn't all deserve to be verse. I said, it's not verse. It's just how I feel comfortable on the page. Well, it looks like verse. It looks like you should really do a combination. You should learn to write the paragraph. And so he said, you should look at Edmund Jabez or Patterson. So I went to the bookstore, and they had the second volume of Book of Questions by Jabez. And I was very scared, but everything's scary for me. So I was very scared. I opened it up, and it was so beautiful on the page. I didn't read it. I just looked at it, how the ink was on the page. And it was very organic, like a creature walking, very beautiful. And so I went to my writing group and said, I think I have to rewrite the novel. They all groaned. No, take this insight into your next work, Mary. It's really finished. But I thought, well, the test will be the text itself. So I got my manuscript out and opened to a random page, which was this text going down the center, and said, like, fix me. So I did. I learned to tolerate going out margin to margin again. And so what we have is this combination of margin to margin and staccato, and it's just kind of the way I would make the decision would be based on really musical considerations. So, but now I'm working in relation to, I read now. So the work I'm doing now, I'm aware that there are form issues that and decisions I made as a naive person that now I would want to make in a more informed manner. But at the time, it was how I felt about my freedom to take up space in the world and on the page. And just as the final note, to me, nothing is better than the plain white page. So, any ink, has to hold up to me, the plain white of the page is not a void. It actually feels to me to contain everything. So that's another prejudice in the book. The white is very, very much a thing that I'm trying to manage the white as much as I am the ink, So again, it was kind of like listening, sort of like musical composition. When do I want the full orchestra? When do I want just an exposed oboe? When do I want the string section? When do I want percussion? That's I try to do it that way.
Mary Rako is our guest. The Memory Room is her book. Other questions or comments?
I have a couple questions. First, Barbara in the story, what her age is in the story, if it varies, and if you've been writing your whole life or if it's something that you've just taken up recently.
No, I haven't been writing my whole life. I mean, I've been writing letters, but I never aspired to be a writer because I didn't have the pleasure of reading fiction or anything. So, but I did go do graduate work, which gave me increased my skill with language, So when I, after graduate school, I felt really a calling to silence. So I just basically didn't pursue anything academic and tried to cultivate silence, which I thought would take me 3 months. Well, after 10 years, I felt I had some bit of it. And that's not an exaggeration. So I gardened and I said the Liturgy of the Hours, which is an organization of the Psalms that cloistered community, anyone can say them, but cloistered Christian communities say the Liturgy of the Hour. They say the Psalter over a certain period of time, and everyone in the world is saying the same thing, every 3 hours of the day, day and night. It's very, very beautiful. There was silence and there was that articulation of the Psalms. But I didn't, I haven't been writing except letters. And I don't have that aspiration, actually. I don't have an aspiration to be a thing, to be a writer. It's happening because that's the thing that I have the best facility with. If I could, I have even other art forms that I would prefer. So it's sort of a default position. But then language has a lot more control than, say, choreography or something like that. You can control the meaning, I think, more than... I can control your experience of Barbara more through language than through dance, I think. So in a way, there's I do like control. So probably language is good for me to work in.
How old is Barbara?
Oh, that's right. Well, it doesn't really matter to me. You can kind of make her any age you want. You know, I see her as an adult, and then she remembers experiences from infancy through college. You know, I'm working now. I'm using her in my new work, and she will be probably about the same age, but she'll be in a 30-year marriage with a grown child. And I know that's sort of logically contradictory, but I don't really care about that contradiction. You know, I think so what. You know, I want to kind of maybe look at her as a subject for the rest of my life from various angles, and you know, it takes a long time to understand a person.
When did you find her voice?
Well, I'm not real sure what would you mean by voice?
I mean, how you're wanting to use her as, well, not use her, but how you view her, I guess, or and how she is, what kind of the character that you envisioned that is now in this work.
She embodies things that I care about and think about in a very autobiographical way. I mean, what she cares and thinks about is very much me. She became a character, not me, at a certain point.
That's what I meant.
That's
the
voice.
Yeah.
I think voice is a tricky thing, mm-hmm. you know, and I didn't think, I care most about what she thinks. I'm not so interested at all in plot, you know, or anything. I mean, so I care mostly about how she thinks about things. I mean, it would be fine for me to write a novel where she just sits in a chair and thinks for 500 pages, you know. So that's just because that's what interests me more in human interaction myself, you know. That's what I like the best.
Can we know a bit more about you, where you're coming from?
Like what time and place? You mean now? Sure.
As far as, well, there's a lot of the religion. I obviously, in your background, immersion in of that. Can we know a bit more about you or not?
No, you can ask anything direct, and I'll answer to the extent I'm comfortable.
Maybe it doesn't matter.
I religion, I'm open. Anything? How you want to know my religious orientation now? Or
well, why you would? I mean, does it have to do with why you would fear coming to literature?
Oh, that's because
embracing literature.
Oh, that's
or
not
embracing the literary form.
Oh,
does it have to do with your religion or
no.
your feelings?
No, actually,
about
that's a good way to get at that. No, actually, I did have a literary influence growing up, which was scripture. So I didn't read childhood books. I read Nancy Drew once. It was horrible. I mean, I couldn't stand it. I was in a camping trip, and my sister brought five of them. You know, she was an avid reader, and I just made myself read it. I couldn't stand it. I like the word roadster, and I like luncheon. I like those two words. But I just couldn't. I could not, you know, reading across the page. I really like making things, so I made puppets and puppet shows. I do like making things. But the Bible, now that I've finished, I think it's not a coincidence that my comfort level is most high with lines that are approximately like, and I grew up with the King James Bible, primarily the Scofield Bible, which is like a study Bible. It's a very in the evangelical tradition. So, and anyway, you have on one page two columns, and of course you have verses numbered. I don't think it's a coincidence now in retrospect that I have the numbered units and the my novel, when I thought it was finished, was all in what would be similar to one column in the Bible. I mean, duh, you know. But I wasn't consciously doing that, you know. But I think that the Bible is a huge influence on my thinking about literature. For one thing, that I grew up, when I was five, I had the books of the Bible memorized. I had large portions of the scripture memorized, and it was no big deal for me that it was one book containing many books. So it's no big deal for me to have a book that has several textures in it, and my new work will be much more complex than that, and it's just very natural. So, you know, you can even have like boring stuff like Leviticus. I mean, you know, it's boring, but it's in there, and you kind of need it, because then you're really excited when you get to the Psalms, you know. And also, like for minimalism, I mean, the Gospels are so minimalistic, you know. So, I mean, I'm very influenced by that. We don't know what Jesus looked like. I mean, we have the whole resurrection in like two verses. You know, we have great gaps. There's no obligation to say what he did on every single year of his life. And I mean, it's very, very selective. And if you read apocryphal literature that didn't make it into the canon, you really see how great the Gospels are. I mean, that stuff's so pious. You know, he makes clay birds and blows on them and they fly away. I mean, it's very different than, you know, raising someone from the dead. So I mean, the Bible has a big influence on me. Yeah.
Okay, Mary Rako, it's wonderful to hear your ways of handling literature. And I'm interested, you mentioned writing group, writers groups. Can you tell us a little bit about your group? There are a number of us here who are in writers groups.
Yeah. I was going to bring, we had a really good write-up in the LA Times about our group, and I thought I brought it, but I didn't, but I can mail you a copy afterwards. You can give me your address. But I'm in a group called Hard Words, and there are 11 women, and it isn't necessarily a women's group, but we have no turnover, and so we're not taking new members, and so it's all still women. But we all originally were with a writer, Kate Braverman, and then formed the group. And actually, there are other people in this room here who are part of, you know, our feeling of community. So I don't know what about it you'd like to know. We're very rigorous. There are lots of writing groups in LA. Many of them are sort of patty cake groups, you know. Oh, this is great, this is brilliant, this is great. You know, they're just a total waste of time. So in our group, there's a real clear line between being friends and then, you know, getting to work. And we do socialize first to kind of establish a level of trust because we come from very different economic, not so different racial, we don't have much diversity racially, but economic, religious, educational, we're very diverse. So we see each other once a month, and we live hours apart. One woman flies in from Arizona. So we socialize for the first hour or so to remember who we are, to establish a loving environment. And then we get very cutthroat when we do critique. And I think the ability to go back and forth between those two, to wear those two hats is really essential. We're very, very supportive. It starts with the work, but now we've been together 8 years and nobody's left. And now we really love each other as human beings too. But I think it's very important to not waste your time with, I'm not going to swear, I almost swore, silliness. You don't need silly, you know, you need someone to love you in the deepest way, which is to help you be your best and to not let you be mediocre. And The Memory Room I think it's a really pretty book. I really love it. And part of the reason I really love it is that all the stuff that I wrote that is not very good has been taken out by my group. That's the truth.
Other questions and real quick comments for Mary Rako, her book, The Memory Room.
Hi. I just was going to ask about one of the things I think you did so deftly in this book was to bring out issues of abuse that are normally kept silent and to make it in a sense that you actually want to speak these poems out loud. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know if you think some of that comes from so many years of silence and in the creation process, were you saying this out loud as you wrote it?
I'm not sure I exactly understand the question. I'm close to it, but can you just rephrase it?
When you are composing at your computer or wherever you were you actually speaking this out loud the whole time you were writing, or was most of this done in continued silence?
Oh, let's see. I'm always
saying... How'd you get there?
Okay, I'm always saying the text out loud, you know, and often walking around and things like that. So I think that saying it out, because the ear and the eye see and hear different things. So I think that that's important, and I care very much about, this is why I study now with Frank Bidart in the summer, I care very much about giving the clues on and how the ink is on the page so that the reader can hear the poem or hear the novel, the text, in the way that I hear it without me being there. And so, you know, that's things of arrangement and punctuation and things like that. And that's important, very important to me.
That's why it was great to have you reading your own work tonight as well. We didn't get to the issue of a collaboration, but we will next time because you're working on another book, as I understand it. Mary Rako, thank you so much
for
being here. The Memory Room, published by Counterpoint. Will Brown engineered this edition. I'm Julie Englander. Good night.